Cashwalk. Chapter 1. An hour after leaving the picnic area where Ray had shot himself with Clay's gun, they passed a sign reading, Northern Counties Expo, October 5 to 15. Come one, come all. Visit Cashwalkamock Hall, and don't forget the unique North End. Slots including Texas Hold'em, Indian Bingo. You'll say, wow.
Oh, my God, Clay said. The Expo. Cashwalkamock Hall, Christ. If there was ever a place for a flock, that's it.
What's an expo? Denise asked.
Your basic county fair, Clay said. Only bigger than most of them, and quite a lot wilder, because it's on the TR, which is unincorporated. Also, there's that North End business. Everyone in Maine knows about the North End at the Northern Counties Expo. In its own way, it's as notorious as the Twilight Motel.
Tom wanted to know what the North End was, but before Clay could explain, Denise said,
There's two more.
Mary and Jesus, I know their phoners, but it still makes me sick.
A man and a woman lay in the dust at the side of the road. They had died either in an embrace or a bitter battle, and embracing did not seem to go with the phoner lifestyle. They had passed half a dozen other bodies on their run north, almost certainly casualties from the flock that had come down to get them, and had seen twice that number wandering aimlessly south, sometimes alone, sometimes in pairs. One of the pairs, clearly confused about where they wanted to go, had actually tried to hitchhike the bus as it passed.
Wouldn't it be nice if they'd all either fall out or drop dead before what they've got planned for us tomorrow? Tom said.
Don't count on it, Dan said. For every casualty or deserter we've seen 20 or 30 who are still with the program. And God knows how many are waiting in this cash-wacky place.
Don't count it out, either, Jordan said from his place beside Tom. He spoke a little sharply. A bug in the program, a worm, is not a small thing. It can start out as a minor pain in the ass and then boom, everything's down. I play this game, Star Mag. Well, you know, I used to play it, and this sore sport out in California got so mad about losing all the time that he put a worm in the system, and it took down all the servers in a week. Almost 500,000 gamers back to computer cribbage because of that jam head.
We don't have a week, Jordan, Denise said.
I know, he said, and I know they're not all apt to go wheels up overnight, but it's possible, and I won't stop hoping. I don't want to end up like Ray.
He stopped, you know, hoping.
A single tear rolled down Jordan's cheek. Tom gave him a hug.
You won't end up like Ray, he said. You're going to grow up to be like Bill Gates.
I don't want to grow up to be like Bill Gates, Jordan said morosely. I bet Bill Gates had a cell phone. In fact, I bet he had a dozen.
He sat up straight.
One thing I'd give a lot to know is how so many cell phone transmission towers can still be working when the fucking power's down.
FEMA, Dan said hollowly.
Tom and Jordan turned to look at him, Tom with a tentative smile on his lips. Even Clay glanced up into the rearview mirror.
You think I'm joking, Dan said. I wish I was. I read an article about it in a news magazine while I was in my doctor's office, waiting for that disgusting exam where he puts on a glove and then goes prospecting.
Please, Denise said. Things are bad enough. You can skip that part.
What did the article say?
That after 9/11, FEMA requested and got a sum of money from Congress, I don't remember how much, but it was in tens of millions, to equip cell phone transmission towers nationwide with long-life emergency generators, to make sure the nation's ability to communicate wouldn't go to hell in the event of coordinated terrorist attacks. He paused.
I guess it worked.
FEMA, Tom said. I don't know whether to laugh or cry.
I'd tell you to write your congressman, but he's probably insane, Denise said.
He was insane well before the pulse, Tom answered, but he spoke absently. He was rubbing the back of his neck and looking out the window.
FEMA, he said.
You know, it sort of makes sense.
Fucking FEMA.
Dan said, I'd give a lot just to know why they've made such a business of collaring us and bringing us in, and making sure the rest of us don't follow Ray's example. Denise said. Don't forget that.
She paused.
Not that I would. Suicide's a sin.
They can do whatever they want to me here, but I'm going to heaven with my baby. I believe that.
The Latin's the part that gives me the creeps, Dan said.
Jordan, is it possible that the phoners could take old stuff? Stuff from before the pulse, I mean, and incorporate it into their new programming? If it fit their, I don't know, their long-term goals?
I guess, Jordan said. I don't really know, because we don't know what sort of commands might have been encoded in the pulse. This isn't like ordinary computer programming in any case. It's self-generating. Organic, like learning.
I guess it is learning.
It satisfies the definition, the head would say.
Only they're all learning together because...
Because of the telepathy, Tom said.
Right,
Jordan agreed. He looked troubled.
Why does the Latin give you the creeps? Clay asked, looking at Dan in the rearview mirror.
Tom said Latin's the language of justice, and I guess that's true, but this feels much more like vengeance to me.
He leaned forward. Behind his glasses, his eyes were tired and troubled.
Because, Latin or no Latin, they can't really think. I'm convinced of that. Not yet, anyway. What they depend on instead of rational thought is a kind of hive mind born out of pure rage.
I object, Your Honor. Freudian speculation, Tom said, rather merrily.
Maybe Freud, maybe Lorenz, Dan said. But give me the benefit of the doubt, either way. Would it be surprising for such an entity, such a raging entity, to confuse justice and vengeance?
Would it matter? Tom asked.
It might to us, Dan said. As someone who once taught a block course on vigilantism in America, I can tell you that vengeance usually ends up hurting more.
Chapter 2. Not long after this conversation, they came to a place Clay recognized, which was unsettling because he had never been in this part of the state before, except once, in his dream of the mass conversions. Written across the road in broad strokes of bright green paint was Cashwalk equals No Foe. The van rolled over the words at a steady 30 miles an hour as the phoners continued to stream past in their stately, witchy procession on the left.
That was no dream, he thought, looking at the drifts of trash caught in the bushes at the sides of the road, the beer and soda cans in the ditches, bags that had contained potato chips, Doritos, and cheese doodles crackled under the tires of the little bus. The normies stood here in a double line, eating their snacks and drinking their drinks, feeling that funny itch in their heads, that weird sense of a mental hand pushing on their backs, waiting their turns to call some loved one who got lost in the pulse. They stood here and listened to the raggedy man say, "Left and right, two lines, that's correct, that's doing it, let's keep moving. We've got a lot of you to process before dark."
Up ahead the trees drew back on either side of the road. What had been some farmer's hard-won grazeland for cows or sheep had now been flattened and churned down to bare earth by many passing feet. It was almost as though there had been a rock concert here. One of the tents was gone, blown away, but the other had caught on some trees and flapped in the dull early evening light like a long brown tongue.
"I dreamed of this place," Jordan said. His voice was tight.
"Did you?" Clay said. "So did I."
"The normies followed the Cashwalk No Foe signs, and this is what they came to," Jordan said. "It was like toll booths, wasn't it, Clay?"
"Kind of," Clay said. "Kind of like toll booths, yeah."
"They had big cardboard boxes full of cell phones," Jordan said.
This was a detail Clay didn't remember from his own dream, but he didn't doubt it.
"Heaps and heaps of them. And every normie got to make a call. What a bunch of lucky ducks." "When did you dream this, Geordie?" Denise asked. "Last night."
Jordan's eyes met Clay's in the rearview mirror.
"They knew they weren't going to be talking to the people they wanted to talk to. Down deep they knew. But they did it anyway. They took the phones anyway, took them and listened. Most of them didn't even put up a fight." "Why, Clay?"
"Because they were tired of fighting, I suppose," Clay said. "Tired of being different. They wanted to hear Baby Elephant walk with new ears."
They were past the beaten-down fields where the tents had been. Ahead, a paved byroad split off from the highway. It was broader and smoother than the state road. The phoners were streaming up this byway and disappearing into a slot in the woods. Looming high above the trees, half a mile or so farther on, was a steel, gantry-like structure Clay recognized at once from his dreams. He thought it had to be some sort of amusement attraction, maybe a parachute drop. There was a billboard at the junction of the highway and the byroad, showing a laughing family, Dad, Mom, Sonny, and Little Sis, walking into a wonderland of rides, games, and agricultural exhibits. Northern Counties Expo. Gala Fireworks Show, October 5th. Visit Kashwakamak Hall. The North End open 24/7, October 5 to 15. You'll say, wow. Standing below this billboard was the Raggedy Man. He raised one hand and held it out in a stop gesture. Oh, Jesus, Clay thought, and pulled the minibus up beside him. The Raggedy Man's eyes, which Clay hadn't been able to get right in his drawing at Gayton, looked simultaneously dazed and full of malevolent interest. Clay told himself it was impossible for them to appear both ways at the same time, but they did. Sometimes the dazed dullness was foremost in them. A moment later, it seemed to be that weirdly unpleasant avidity. He can't want to get on with us. But the Raggedy Man did, it seemed. He lifted his hands to the door with the palms pressed together, then opened them. The gesture was rather pretty, like a man indicating, this bird has flown. But the hands themselves were black with filth, and the little finger on the left one had been badly broken in what looked like two places. These are the new people, Clay thought. Telepaths who don't take baths. Don't let him on, Denise said. Her voice was trembling. Clay, who could see that the steady conveyor movement of phoners to the left of the bus had stopped, shook his head. No choice. They peek in your head and find out you're thinking about a fucking cell phone, Ray had said, had almost snorted. What else is anyone thinking about since October 1st? Hope you're right, Ray, he thought, because it's still an hour and a half until dark. An hour and a half at least. He threw the lever that opened the door, and the Raggedy Man, torn lower lip drooping in its constant sneer, climbed aboard. He was painfully thin. The filthy red sweatshirt hung on him like a sack. None of the normies on the bus were particularly clean. Hygiene hadn't been a priority since the 1st of October. But the Raggedy Man gave off a ripe and powerful stench that almost made Clay's eyes water. It was the smell of strong cheese left to sweat it out in a hot room. The Raggedy Man sat down in the seat by the door, the one that faced the driver's seat, and looked at Clay. For a moment there was nothing but the dusty weight of his eyes and that strange, grinning curiosity. Then Tom spoke, in a thin, outraged voice Clay had heard him use only once before, when he'd said, "That's it, everybody out of the pool," to the plump, Bible-toting woman who'd started preaching her end-time sermon to Alice. "What do you want from us? You have the world such as it is. What do you want from us?" The Raggedy Man's ruined mouth formed the word even as Jordan said it. Only that one word, flat and emotionless. "Justice." "When it comes to justice," Dan said, "I don't think you have a clue." The Raggedy Man replied with a gesture, raising one hand to the feeder road, palm up and index finger pointing. "Get rolling." When the bus started to move, most of the phoners started to move again as well. A few more had fallen to fighting, and in the outside mirror, Clay saw others walking back down the Expo feeder road toward the highway. "You're losing some of your troops," Clay said. The Raggedy Man made no reply on behalf of the flock. His eyes, now dull, now curious, now both, remained fixed on Clay, who fancied he could almost feel that gaze walking lightly over his skin. The Raggedy Man's twisted fingers, gray with dirt, lay on the lap of his grimy blue jeans. Then he grinned. Maybe that was answer enough. Dan was right after all. For every phoner who dropped out, who went wheels up, in Jordan speak, there were plenty more. But Clay had no idea how many plenty more might entail, until half an hour later, when the woods opened up on both sides and they passed beneath the wooden arch reading, "Welcome to the Northern Counties Expo."
Chapter 3.
"Dear God," Dan said.
Denise articulated Clay's own feelings better. She gave a low scream. Sitting across the narrow aisle of the little bus in the first passenger seat, the raggedy man only sat and stared at Clay with the half-vacant malevolence of a stupid child about to pull the wings off a few flies.
"Do you like it?" his grin seemed to say. "It's quite something, isn't it? The gang's all here."
Of course, a grin like that could mean that, or anything. It could even mean, "I know what you have in your pocket." Beyond the arch was a midway and a batch of rides, both still being assembled at the time of the pulse from the way things looked. Clay didn't know how many of the carny pitch tents had been erected, but some had blown away, like the pavilions at the checkpoint 6 or 8 miles back. And only half a dozen or so still stood, their sides seeming to breathe in the evening breeze. The Crazy Cups were half-built, and so was the funhouse across from it. "We dare you to..." ran across the single piece of facade that had been erected. Skeletons danced above the words. Only the Ferris wheel and the parachute drop at the far end of what would have been the midway looked complete. And with no electric lights to make them jolly, they looked gruesome to Clay, less like amusement rides than gigantic implements of torture. Yet one light was blinking, he saw. A tiny red beacon, surely battery-powered, at the very top of the parachute drop. Well beyond the drop was a white building with red trim, easily a dozen barn lengths long. Loose hay had been heaped along the sides. American flags, fluttering in the evening breeze, had been planted in this cheap, rural insulation every 10 feet or so. The building was draped with swags of patriotic bunting and bore the legend, "Northern Counties Expo, Kashwakamak Hall," in bright blue paint. But none of this was what had attracted their attention. Between the parachute drop and Kashwakamak Hall were several acres of open ground. Clay guessed it was where the big crowds gathered for livestock exhibitions, tractor pulls, end-of-fair day concerts, and of course the fireworks shows that would both open and close the expo. It was ringed with light standards and loudspeaker poles. Now this broad and grassy mall was crammed with phoners. They stood shoulder to shoulder and hip to hip, their faces turned to watch the arrival of the little yellow bus. Any hope Clay had harbored of seeing Johnny or Sharon was gone in a moment. His first thought was that there had to be 5,000 people crowded beneath those dead light standards. Then he saw they had spilled into the grassy parking lots adjoining the main exhibition area as well, and revised his estimate upward. 8,000 at least. The raggedy man sat where some Newfield Elementary School third grader belonged, grinning at Clay with his teeth jutting through the split in his lip. "Do you like it?" that grin seemed to ask, and again Clay had to remind himself that you could read anything into a grin like that.
"So, who's playing tonight? Vince Gill? Or did you guys break the bank and get Alan Jackson?"
That was Tom. He was trying to be funny, and Clay gave him high marks for that. But Tom only sounded scared. The raggedy man was still looking at Clay, and a little vertical crease had appeared in the middle of his brow, as if something puzzled him. Clay drove the minibus slowly up the center of the midway, toward the parachute drop and the silent multitude beyond. There were more bodies here. They reminded Clay of how you sometimes found heaps of dead bugs on the windowsills after a sudden cold snap. He concentrated on keeping his hands loose. He didn't want the raggedy man to see his knuckles turn white on the wheel. "And go slow. Nice and easy does it. He's only looking at you. As for cell phones, what else has anyone been thinking about since October 1st? The raggedy man raised a hand and pointed one twisted, badly used finger at Clay.
"No fo' you," Clay said in that other voice. "Insanus."
"Yeah, no fo' me. No fo' none of us. We're all bozos on this bus.
Clay said. But you'll fix that, right? The Raggedy Man grinned, as if to say that was right. But the little vertical line was still there, as if something still puzzled him. Maybe something rolling and tumbling around in Clay Riddell's mind. Clay looked up into the rearview mirror as they neared the end of the midway. Tom, you asked me what the north end was, he said. Forgive me, Clay, but my interest seems to have waned, Tom said. Maybe it's the size of the welcoming committee. No, but this is interesting, Clay said, a little feverishly. Okay, what is it? Jordan asked. God bless Jordan. Curious to the end. The Northern Counties Expo was never a big deal in the 20th century, Clay said. Just your standard little shitpot Aggie fair with arts, crafts, produce, and animals over there in Kashwakamak Hall, which is where they're going to put us from the look of things. He glanced at the Raggedy Man, but the Raggedy Man neither confirmed nor denied. The Raggedy Man only grinned. The little vertical line had disappeared from his forehead. Clay, look out, Denise said in a tight, controlled voice. He looked back through the windshield and stepped on the brake. An elderly woman with infected lacerations on both legs came swaying out of the silent crowd. She skirted the edge of the parachute drop, trampled over several prefab pieces of the funhouse that had been laid out but not erected at the time of the pulse, then broke into a shambling run aimed directly at the school bus. When she reached it, she began to hammer slowly on the windshield with filthy, arthritis-twisted hands. What Clay saw in this woman's face wasn't the avid blankness he'd come to associate with the phoners, but terrified disorientation. And it was familiar. "Who are you?" Pixie Dark had asked. Pixie Dark, who hadn't gotten a direct blast of the pulse. "Who am I?" 9 phoners in a neat, moving square came after the elderly woman, whose frantic face was less than 5 feet from Clay's own. Her mouth moved, and he heard 4 words, both with his ears and with his mind. "Take me with you." "We're not going anywhere you want to go, lady," Clay thought. Then the phoners grabbed her and took her back toward the multitude on the grassy mall. She struggled to get away, but they were relentless. Clay caught one flash of her eyes and thought they were the eyes of a woman who was in purgatory, only if she was lucky. More likely it was hell. Once more the Raggedy Man held out his hand, palm up, and index finger pointing. Roll. The elderly woman had left a handprint, ghostly but visible, on the windshield. Clay looked through it and got rolling. Chapter 4. "Anyhow," he said, "until 1999, the expo was no big deal. If you lived in this part of the world and wanted rides and games, carny stuff, you had to go down to the Freiburg Fair." He heard his own voice running, as if on a tape loop. Talk for the sake of talk. It made him think of the drivers on the duck boat tours in Boston, pointing out the various sights. "Then, just before the turn of the century, the State Bureau of Indian Affairs did a land survey. Everybody knew the expo grounds were right next door to the Saca Basin Res. What that land survey showed was that the north end of Kashwakamak Hall was actually on reservation land. Technically, it was in Mi'kmaq Indian territory. The people running the expo were no dummies, and neither were the ones on the Mi'kmaq Tribal Council. They agreed to clean out the little shops from the north end of the hall and put in slots. All at once, the Northern Counties Expo was Maine's biggest fall fair." They had reached the parachute drop. Clay started to jog left and guide the little bus between the ride and the half-constructed funhouse, but the Raggedy Man patted his hands on the air, palms down. Clay stopped. The Raggedy Man stood up and turned to the door. Clay threw the lever, and the Raggedy Man stepped off. Then he turned to Clay and made a kind of sweeping, bowing gesture. "What's he doing now?" Denise asked. She couldn't see from where she was sitting. None of them could. "He wants us to get off," Clay said. He stood up. He could feel the cell phone Ray had given him lying hard along his upper thigh. If he looked down, he would see its outline against the blue denim of his jeans. He pulled down the t-shirt he was wearing, trying to cover it. A cell phone, so what? Everybody's thinking about them. Are we going too?
Jordan asked. He sounded scared.
Not much choice, Clay said.
Come on, you guys. Let's go to the fair.
Chapter 5.
The Raggedy Man led them toward the silent multitude. It opened for them, leaving a narrow aisle, not much more than a throat, from the back of the parachute drop to the double doors of Cashwakamak Hall. Clay and the others passed a parking area filled with trucks. New England Amusement Corp. was printed on the sides, along with a roller coaster logo. Then the crowd swallowed them. That walk seemed endless to Clay. The smell was nearly insupportable, wild and ferocious, even with the freshening breeze to carry the top layer away. He was aware of his legs moving. He was aware of the Raggedy Man's red hoodie ahead of him. But the hall's double doors with their swags of red, white, and blue bunting seemed to get no closer. He smelled dirt and blood, urine and shit. He smelled fermenting infections, burned flesh, the spoiled egg-white aroma of oozing pus. He smelled clothes that were rotting on the bodies they draped. He smelled something else as well, some new thing. Calling it madness would have been too easy.
I think it's the smell of telepathy. And if it is, we're not ready for it. It's too strong for us. It burns the brain somehow, the way too much current will burn out the electrical system in a car, or a...
Help me with her! Jordan yelled from behind him. Help me with her! She's fainting!
He turned and saw that Denise had gone down on all fours. Jordan was on all fours beside her and had one of her arms over his neck, but she was too heavy for him. Tom and Dan couldn't get forward enough to help. The corridor cutting through the mass of phoners was too narrow. Denise raised her head, and for a moment her eyes met Clay's. The look was one of dazed incomprehension, the eyes those of a slugged steer. She vomited a thin gruel onto the grass, and her head dropped down again. Her hair fell around her face like a curtain.
Help me!
Jordan shouted again. He began to cry. Clay went back and started elbowing phoners in order to get on Denise's other side.
Get out of the way, he shouted. Get out of the way! She's pregnant! Can't you fools see she's preg-
It was the blouse he recognized first. The high-necked white silk blouse that he had always called Sharon's doctor shirt. In some ways he thought it was the sexiest garment she owned, partly because of that high, prim neck. He liked her bare, but he liked to touch and squeeze her breasts through that high-necked white silk blouse even more. He liked to bring her nipples up until he could see them poking the cloth. Now Sharon's doctor shirt was streaked black with dirt in some places and maroon with dried blood in others. It was torn under the arm.
She doesn't look as bad as some, Johnny had written, but she didn't look good.
She certainly wasn't the Sharon Riddell who had gone off to school in her doctor shirt and her dark red skirt, while her estranged husband was in Boston, about to make a deal that would put an end to their financial worries and make her realize that all her carping about his expensive hobby had been so much fear and bad faith. That, anyway, had been his semi-resentful dream. Her dark blonde hair hung in lank strings. Her face had been cut in a number of places, and one of her ears looked torn half off. Where it had been, a clotted hole bored into the side of her head. Something she had eaten, something dark, clung in curds to the corners of the mouth he had kissed almost every day for almost 15 years. She stared at him, through him, with that idiotic half-grin they sometimes wore.
"Clay, help me!"
Jordan almost sobbed. Clay snapped back. Sharon wasn't here. That was the thing to remember. Sharon hadn't been here for almost 2 weeks now. Not since trying to make a call on Johnny's little red cell phone on the day of the pulse.
"Give me some room, you bitch," he said, and pushed aside the woman who'd been his wife.
Before she could rebound, he slid into her place.
"This woman's pregnant, so give me some fucking room."
Then he bent, slipped Denise's other arm over his neck, and got her up.
"Go on ahead," Tom said to Jordan. "Let me in. I've got her."